Well, hello, and a very warm welcome back to the Andrew Ewan Show and another thrilling episode of A Pair of Briefs. I'm joined yet again by the wonderful Stephen Barrett. How are we doing, Stephen?
Good, good. Looking forward to doing the school pickup soon and
Ah,
seeing my small child. It's always
it's
a blessing.
always important, and it's so good. Front and center, family life is so important for everybody. Always, getting priorities right and everybody else. We talk about what's going on in the world and how horrible it is. It's the family that it's the nucleus of society. And I think the more we can shine a spotlight on that, the better.
I think, well, particularly as a message to young people themselves, I think they need to realize that, for whatever they think I've succeeded in life, the only success I recognize is my child. And that's the thing I'm most proud of,
Absolutely.
without
And
any
people always
question.
talk about finance. As you know, Errol Musk, the father of Elon, is on my show virtually every day. And we talk about these sort of things. And measuring success is not about money. It's about, happiness and things like that. I mean, Elon, nobody would want Elon's life if you looked at it. He's so incredibly busy. He doesn't go out to restaurants, doesn't really go on holidays. He's permanently, actually, at Mar-a-Lago at the moment. But you're working on that sort of basis. What you want to have is sort of happiness in your life and human rights, if you like, the fundamental things that people are allowed to do. And I thought it might be worth looking at in this episode. Let's talk about, we've been looking at international law, what that means, this sort of contract between kings effectively. Let's look at human rights and humanitarian law and how international law protects human rights and look at that sort of side. Talk me through some of that.
Well, does it? So there's this theory that courts will protect human rights, and I have seen no evidence to support this theory ever since I first heard it in the 1990s. Viewers and listeners should know that I was a massive worshipper of human rights and a massive fan of the ECHR. So where I'm coming from now is, somebody who has just been disheartened with the entire thing. And I think that there is a fund there's a lawyer who has a very different politics from me, but he's one of the good ones who can put down his politics. And he's on Twitter, but he's anonymous, or he's not, because we all know who he is. But I always call him the least anonymous account on Twitter. But I can't say who he is because he's anonymous, because I'm honest and honourable. But every lawyer watching this now knows exactly which account I mean. But he and I agree that this is just a bonkers thing to believe. It is bonkers. Look at judges. They are lovely. They are brilliant, but they are little old ladies and little old men. They are not going to defend anything. Okay? If you want to defend something, you need the 20-year-old males. Okay? That's what you need. It's just fundamental, and every society that has thought this, it has been proven wrong. So the Weimar Republic had what I consider the first version of human rights, and in theory, the Constitution prevented Hitler. And of course, as we know, the German judges prevented Hitler, and we never had the Second World War. I mean, it's bonkers. In theory, the Russian Constitution has human rights. They're a member of the ECHR, for goodness sake. And every time we suggest leaving it, they're like, we'll be like Russia. It's like, I don't think we will, because it didn't do any good for them. It didn't work. The Russian Constitution prevents, says Putin's not lawful. It says that that there are human rights, and it's no, there are no, I don't believe that there are. In theory, all these human rights, I mean, having Iran as president of the UN, I mean, this is just a joke. This is a sick perversion. And it comes from this fundamental belief that judges will protect human rights, and judges will stop another Second World War, judges will stop another Holocaust. And it's like, no, we will stop another Second World War, we will stop another Holocaust by being decent people who don't accept racism. And so that's a magic. But this is the 90s, Andrew. It's everything in the 90s was this idea that somebody else will do it for you. And we just need to get rid of this idea. Oh, somebody else will do. Got pollution in your rivers? Somebody else will do that for you. Got a corrupt media landscape? Someone else will do that for you. And then all these bloody regulators that don't do anything, don't work, because somebody else isn't going to do it for us. We're all here. It's our country. If we want it to be a good country, we have to get involved. If we don't get involved, it'll be a
And
rubbish.
it's a mindset, and it's why I sort of talking about family at the beginning. They always say, well, they say that to bring up a child takes a village. it. Well, actually, if you work on that sort of principle that we're all responsible, and you call it out and we take whatever steps we can, the world's going to be a much better place, isn't it?
Yes, it will be. And our constitution's based on that principle. So we have a constitution that requires volunteers. And that's we're almost unique in that, and that we the amount of volunteers we require. We require volunteer judges. They're called magistrates. We require volunteers to run every single school in this country is ultimately run and managed by volunteer governors. Every single charity is run and managed by volunteer trustees. We have volunteers throughout everything. I mean, the whole guide and scouting movement, volunteers, all of them are volunteers. Even down to my child's school's Christmas fair, all the tables were staffed by volunteers. And this is what we have to get. And this 90s mindset that, oh, no, everything will be done by someone else. A professional will do that. A professional will do it properly. He'll do it at a much higher standard. We'll have professional regulators. They'll keep your. And it's just nonsense. We need to go back to understanding our constitution and to volunteering. And if we don't volunteer, we will, bad things will happen.
Yeah,
But I,
and pe
this, I,
people always raise the issue of fees, and I always say that a fee is a fair exchange of energy. And if you're working out on that sort of basis that we all contribute to the society, we're all going to be better off. And I think that's that whole sort of idea of community is going to make the world a better place as well, isn't it?
yes, and we need to go back to respecting the honours system because it was a great way of rewarding people that didn't cost the state anything. And we need to go back to giving honours not automatically to all sorts of people, but actually to the volunteers. I would rather that the lady who's run the scouts for 40 years gets a damehood than some failed politician. It just
No,
is.
absolutely. And well, there are certain jobs that automatically go with the honours, but also every time the honours list comes out, people don't focus on all the good ones. What they focus on, say that the only reason he or she got that is because they did this, as opposed to something good. They curried a bit of favour, or they helped somebody out of a sticky situation, or they paid a bit of money. And actually, we should be focusing on the really good stuff and encourage people to do that because that's the reward. As I say, a fee is a fair exchange of energy. And if you get recognition, that's sometimes far more important than just a lump sum of money.
Yes, it is. But yeah, I'm afraid the idea that human rights courts will protect human rights globally has absolutely zero evidence. The world today is in no way materially better than it was 30 years ago because of human rights. I haven't seen, everywhere where bad things happen, the bad things have happened. No court has ever stopped them. No court has ever stood in their way. The fact that we've not had bad things happen here is not hasn't got anything to do with an office building in Strasbourg. It's got everything to do with the fact that we here want to be decent people. So I always so I'm,
So
as a
is the answer to the question then, how does international law protect human rights? Is the answer, well, it doesn't.
Yeah, I think that is my answer. I genuinely do not believe it does. And I'm a bisexual and I'm accepted in our society. And the reason I'm accepted in our society is that everybody in our society is lovely, kind, and nice. It's got nothing to do. They're not doing it because they're scared of Strasbourg. Ooh, Strasbourg will get me. Ooh. It's because they're nice, decent, kind people. And that is fundamentally what goes on, and it is just an utter misconception. You got this man in the 90s, this American lawyer who made an awful lot of money writing these books that basically espoused this idea. It's called Ronnie Dworkin, and he wrote The Judge's Superman, The Judge's Hercules. Judges will save us. Judges will do this and this and this. Judges are so cool. And he, as I say, made vast amounts of money. I bought into all this, so I used to read all his books, and I used to believe, yes, judges are, blah, blah, blah. And then I met them, and it's just falls out of all plausibility. And if me and that least anonymous person on Twitter, who are really quite politically different, but we both recognize this is just silly. But Andrew, they have a tactic up their sleeve, which is that if I say all this, they'll say, Stephen doesn't like human rights. Which human right don't you like? And it's just like, this is pathetic. I'm not 12. This is not how you argue. I'm saying it doesn't work. I'm not saying that I don't like human rights. Just shut up.
Oh, no,
But
we all like human right, and the one human right that we always talk about is freedom of speech, and the reason that that everybody has a pop at Sir Keir Starmer, the easy rhyming two-tier Keir, is you say that the big thing that you'll get away if you're stealing phones and you're doing the thefts from shops and so on and so forth, but you say something that might hurt somebody, we've got a bit of jail space for you, and that's the whole sort of principle there. Human rights and the fundamental thing about freedom of speech, what protections do we actually have?
almost none. Almost none. We have to rely on Strasbourg, which most of us can't get to. I mean, that's the other thing about these bloody, Strasbourg, unless it's going to get them a load of newspaper headlines, it's something like 7 years from application to hearing to even go to Strasbourg. So we're not going to do that. And the lefty lawyers who do human rights are not going to work for free for us because we're not going to be sympathetic cause. They're going to bang about the causes they want. So we can't even really get to Strasbourg, let alone is it going to actively protect us. We've incorporated ECHR, the rights, into our law. So in theory, our judges would defend us, but how well did that work at Southport?
Well,
I don't see.
exactly. Well, we had a very practical example, a friend of yours, I think my Tusi as well, who's being threatened at one stage with being arrested. And I remember Andre Walker, another mutual friend, was sort of saying, well, he'll raise all this money to get the best lawyer in town to do it. Talk to me about that practicality, because you say if you don't have access to Strasbourg, what's going to happen in that instance?
Well, Maya has access to me, so there is that. To be perfectly honest, I can't do that for everybody, but I think it does make a difference. So does Alison Pearson. There's other people have I'm and because I'm on Twitter, every time there's some sort of major scandal, I tend to sort of try and assist if I can, because we must push back against all of this. It is absolute tosh, but we're
But
seeing the
talk to me
fruit.
about that. I mean, absolutely. I mean, we've mentioned about Alison beforehand. You mentioned about Maya and so on and so forth. You say you're there to assist, and what does that assistance mean in practice?
Well, it depends on the case, but it usually means pushing back, because there are arguments that you can deploy that people forget and aren't used.
Give me examples of those. I mean, I had Lawrence Fox on. I was speaking about him. I mean, he's had the police around his place. It was slightly different because it was about a criminal damage case, you might remember, and the whole sort of the ULEZ thing and the criminal suggestions of criminal damage. But that was dropped. And the case against Alison was dropped. I think Maya that never really happened in the end. Either was scared off by the media. But in terms of practical terms, if somebody is threatened with this because of a tweet that they've done, or another social media post, what should they do?
I think people should contact lawyers as soon as they possibly can. If they really can't afford a lawyer, then I think they should go to the Citizens Advice Bureau. I think that we really must push back and fight. I would urge people to not give in. I can't advise any individual, but it strikes me as notable that the people who didn't plead guilty are actually doing better than the people who plead. This idea that you plead guilty and everything's great, well, I don't think that worked out terribly well for a lot of the people who are now currently in prison. So, that's one to take professional advice on. But I do worry. I do worry about that instance. There is something called Ziegler. So it's a case that's in our court. And we pushed back against it because it went too far. I don't know if people will remember, but Ziegler was the reason that the Met Police weren't arresting the Just Stop Oil protesters when they blocked roads and things. And when they
Just
did.
remind us, so unpack the case, because it's easy for those who may not be as familiar as you are.
Ziegler says that all crimes have to be proportionate to your right to freedom of speech. And that still exists as a principle. We pushed back against it, and the Lord Chancellor, the Lady Chief Justice, said that that doesn't apply where if you're causing criminal damage. So if you're actually causing, but Lawrence wasn't. I mean, that the other thing is we live in an epidemic of people who don't understand the causation of things. So they be, I mean, to be to credit, to be. For charitable to them, they genuinely believe that a tweet will cause violence, and that I just don't think that's in any way plausible. How is it causing it, you know? And that's really, that's where to stick your pick and bang your hammer. Prove I've caused it. Prove it. How have I caused it? You have to prove it. It's your case. And the prosecution has to prove everything it alleges. Prove I've caused anything, you know? And then this is why they didn't prosecute Nigel. Because how the hell would you prove that Nigel caused anything? How would you do that? Well, go on then. Good luck. Best of luck. And then you have to show that everything that they're doing is proportionate to freedom of speech rights, which is what I think worked with Alice. They have to say that prosecution is in the public interest. How is this in the public interest? Challenge that. I want to know this. And that, I think, is what people should do. But we live in a society that is. I think, again, to be charitable, I think people are out of control of their. They've let their fears get out of control. Because a really striking feature is that we get hysterical now about something that might cause violence, and then when actual violence happens, we don't seem to mind. You know, and people don't get very good sentences. People get suspended sentences for quite a violent incident, but we don't seem to mind. But the idea that this might cause violence, and therefore that's because it's a very human thing, but anticipation of fear is worse than experiencing a bad thing. It's always worse. Now that's evolved deliberately so that we would get up off our lazy bottoms and run away from the possibility that there's a tiger, just in case there's a tiger, you know. And it's evolutionary beneficial if you are more afraid of anticipated things than things that actually happen. When things are happening, you need control of your faculties and you need to, you know, be able to deal with whatever's going on. So people often talk about how much calmer they were than they thought they would be, you know, when in this X situation. And so I think to be charitable, people have just let their fear get out of control. But really, the one to keep banging on is cause. How did this cause anything? And I don't think that they can prove
Yeah,
causation
and
at
it's
all.
a really important point, and one of I say the letters flood in daily in the good old way as a response to these. And one of the ones that you had as a result of a previous pair of briefs was talking about the right to silence, if you like, is that somebody doesn't they don't have to stand up and say, "Here's my defence." It's not for you to put a defence, it's for the prosecution to prove.
Yes, because it is the wielding of state power against civilians. And going back again to the Civil War, we don't believe the king has the right to throw us in prison just because he wants to. We believe that you can go to prison, sure, but only if it's fairly proved that you actually did it. And we work on the basis, and we always have done, and I don't want us to change. We work on the basis that it's better for 99 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be put in prison. And
Yeah,
that
no,
is the
and it's
basis
something
of our
I've
justice.
always said, and my concern, internally as a lawyer who's seen it from the very, very early stages of my career, is so often you're dependent on who's the best mouthpiece. And we've got to get away from that because the whole idea of justice being blind and so on and so forth and easy access to everybody to do that means that the credibility of the justice system will fail if you are just dependent on that good mouthpiece.
Yes, well, I mean, we really need to restructure the justice system so that it provides access to justice for British citizens. And one of my concerns is that we spend an awful lot of money on legal aid for people who aren't citizens. And I don't know why we do that. And I, you know, at the same time, I am concerned about access to justice. I'm not sure most people have access to justice in any real or ready capacity. And I would much rather get that back. But no, the answer to do international, do human rights courts protect human rights is no.
No, that is simple on that sort of way. So I'm also very keen to look at sort of practical things and dealing with that sort of side. So a quite depressing statement that they don't really help human rights. There are practical steps that people do, one of which is you say consult a lawyer as quickly as possible. A lot of people, as you rightly point out, can't afford lawyers because they're expensive. In that situation, somebody's knocking at the door. They say, "Right, we've seen this tweet that you've done, and it might have been a year ago. You might not even remember." what it is. In fact, we're not going to tell you what particular tweet it is, but you're going to be arrested. They can't afford a lawyer. What's the practical stage they should do?
That Citizens Advice Bureau, then that's the but they should get lawyers for crime. I mean, I'm not this is but this is where tyranny lurks. It lurks in the little things. What possible punishment was Alison ultimately, what possible punishment were they going to merit out? Nothing. The punishment was the process. And we have to be aware of this. And I think as a society, we have to start writing to our MPs and saying we've become a country that we don't want to live in
Well,
because
it is all. I mean,
it's
Alison's
oppressive.
case. I mean, she spoke about it publicly, so I presume we can, and she's got not a problem with that. In fact, she's retweeted some of my stuff as well, when I'm talking about it. I mean, her one. I mean, it actually the horrendous experience of having the police come to her. I think it was on Thanksgiving, wasn't it?
It was
And
Remembrance Sunday.
Remembrance Sunday. That's what I remember. It was a big event. Remembrance Sunday. Yes, Remembrance Sunday. More appropriately. And what happened is they sort of they brought on an asthma attack for her, didn't it?
The thing that I always remember is that she ended up not going. So she was getting ready to go down to her local war memorial, stand there, show respect, as many of us do, Remembrance Sunday. And she just ended up not just, oh, I can't deal with this. And
Yes.
that just shows you that for me just sums up everything. It's like, right, that's what we've achieved, is it? That's the outcome we've achieved. Well, we should be really proud as a civilization that that's what we've achieved.
Yeah.
And
As I say, it was around that period. It absolutely was Remembrance Day. Thanksgiving's around the same sort of time. That's how we sort of remember both of those. But she was calling out, and I'd be interested in your opinion, although I probably know what the answer will be, to abolish these non crime hate incidents because they seem to absorb a huge amount of time. We've talked about this in a previous episode. What's your headline on that?
well, if the human rights courts protected human rights, they'd be abolished already. They obviously a threat to freedom of speech. They are admitting that they're not a crime. So what the hell are they for? And this is a complete perversion of power. It's effectively corruption of the police because they were invented by the College of Policing, and they've just given themselves a ridiculous power to harass people. And it's just, on what basis are we allowing the police to harass people? This is just nonsense. And the other thing is that it's often I've looked in quite a few of these, often in defense of the worst people in our society. I mean, there are incidents where people have the process has harassed people on behalf of convicted sex offenders. What? I mean, just, I think we do need to start talking to our MPs, writing in, because everybody watching, listening to this has an MP, whether they know it or not, their MP will actually talk to them. You can track them down, you can meet them, you can chat to them. Everybody watching, listening to this has a counsellor, at least one. They've probably got several. You can write to them and track them down too and meet them. And you start saying to them, I don't like how this country is. I don't want to live this way. I don't want to live this way. It's monstrous. It's a totalitarian police state on the basis of hurty feelings. It's pathetic. I want to go back to being a grown-up country. But yeah, look how pathetic. Look, the other one I get, Andrew, so Article 2 is the right to life.
Yes.
Article 2 only allows the death penalty for crimes. So Article 2 would prevent euthanasia. Why are we having Parliament debating assisted dying when it's obviously a breach of Article 2? And the answer to that, I'm afraid, Andrew, is that the ECHR was asked and it went, oh, it's a living document, and therefore just didn't do anything. It didn't say, no, you can't have euthanasia laws. It's basically allowed them. It didn't, I mean, the one win is that it didn't want to impose euthanasia laws on everybody, which would have been a complete perversion of the convention if they actually imposed a euthanasia law. I mean, just the words meaning the opposite of what they mean really gets my goat. But in if human rights worked, we wouldn't even be debating the assisted dying bill, which again I'm publicly against. I loathe the idea of the state being able to kill us. A state that can come knock on our door for non-crime incidents is bad enough. One that can kill us is just no, shut it down. Don't want
And
I
just, I
don't
mean,
want to live
just
here.
on that, I mean, it's interesting your views on that sort of side. People like Esther Rents, and they're talking about it's a right to life, if you like. They have a right to a quality of life. Obviously, people talk about safeguards. You want to make sure there's not pressures on people, whether it's even internal pressures to think, I don't want to be a burden on everybody, therefore I'll take the, oh, it's not easy, but I'll take that particular way out. What do you say to them?
So the theory is that you can create safeguards, and the reality is that you can't. So it's a nice theory that if you have an office block in Strasbourg, you'll have human rights across the world. It's a lovely theory. It's a lovely thing to believe in. And you can see why people get angry at me when I point out it doesn't work. They're like, why don't you want the world to be good and just? And I do want the world to be good and just. I promise I'm not a baddie. But it's very easy to paint me as a baddie because, and the people who want assisted dying will be like, why do you want people to live in pain? Well, I don't. I expect palliative care to be so good that people don't live in pain. That's point one. I pay, we have a health service. I pay taxes. I expect it to make sure people don't die in agony. Thank you. And anyone that is, I consider that to be a negligent doctor. And let's address doctor negligence, which, by the way, is massive. The NHS pays out so much every year in doctor negligence. It's untrue. So you just for a start, the NHS is pretty bad already. With the power to kill us, it will get worse. Switzerland is a very sophisticated and developed and wealthy country, which has really paid attention to how things are going on. Switzerland manages to have it in one hospital, which they watch like a hawk, and it's probably better to have it in one hospital. We're talking about having it in every hospital. I can't guarantee that every hospital supplies clean drinking water. I can't guarantee that every hospital is actually bacteria free, let alone virus free. How am I going to provide safe and effective death? It's just not the scale of it's untrue, and they know this, which is why that they're hiding behind nonsense. There is no high court judge that's going to be involved, and there's no process whereby a judge could actually make any informed decision. That's tosh. It's gibberish. They had to come out and
So,
admit it.
are there any circumstances at all where you think it should be allowed?
Well, if somebody was in absolute agony and we didn't have any power to end their agony, then yes. But the levels of safeguarding would be so expensive that they could not be replicated on a mass level. That's all. What I'm saying is this thing is would be so, to do it properly. But then again, you'd want the involvement of a judge. Well, that's going to take time, and the death is. So what I much prefer is our current system, which is where I don't necessarily, I think blind eyes are turned, Andrew. And I'll say no more than that because I think it's just better that way. But you don't need state mandated killing to fix this problem. I don't believe that there is a crushing problem to fix. And they're running around trying to pretend there's a problem, but I'm not sure that there is. There's some people who are really scared that they will be in pain. That Esther Manson is obviously really scared of that, but she's not in pain. Okay? So just because she's scared of something, again, anticipation of something is far worse than the actual thing. And we shouldn't make, decisions, really important decisions, on the basis of the anticipation of fear. We as humans need to realize our limit, and when we, just need to calm down a bit.
Yeah, a very
Anticipate.
emotive subject. We'll continue to look at that. It is going to be debated much further, and the arguments both sides have been very eloquently put. I want to just deal finally in this episode with Britain's become the Western capital for Sharia law courts. There's 85 open throughout the UK. Explain to us what a Sharia court is, and how it applies, and why it's become so relevant now.
So in the last episode, I talked about the New York Convention and the Arbitration Act. So because the Arbitration Act is so flexible, it allows religious courts. It also allows things like Judge Rinder. And Judge Judy she doesn't use our Arbitration Act, but she uses the New York Convention and however their system works with that she's permitted because with the arbitration systems. And if people wanted to, they could pay me to be an arbitrator and resolve their disputes. They could pay you. They're literally, we allow people a huge amount of flexibility to use whatever system they want. As a result, certain religions have religious courts. So the Sikhs have religious courts, the Jews have religious courts, and the Muslims have religious courts. I'm pretty sure the Catholics have got some as well. But anyway, we're not, nobody's limiting these. So we've just said everybody can have religious courts. What we do is we limit their powers. So there's a bit of a rumor going around about divorce. Like, no. You can only get married in English law, and you can only get divorced in English law. Anything else isn't real. Okay, it's just not recognized as a marriage. If people are worried about bad practices in certain communities, and they may have valid concerns, then I think that the police should investigate and we should enforce the laws we currently have. We don't need to change a law, is my particular view. I quite like the flexible system. It just needs enforcement. What is crucial, and that's true of arbitration and it's true of religious court, is that it must be by choice and both parties must consent. And if there's a problem, like if we're saying actually we don't think the women in particular are voluntarily choosing this, then let's police and enforce that. And that's the line to hold, that it, they shouldn't, nobody should be forced to use a court unless they want to. There was a bit of a scandal in the Jewish court where some nasty husbands were refusing to agree a divorce in the Beth Din. And the way that that was dealt with was by the Jewish Chronicle covering it. And the Jewish community coming together and saying, look, this is not acceptable. We don't want this to happen. It wasn't solved by the British state coming in and saying you can't have the Beth Din. That is not the answer. And I wouldn't deny or want to deny anybody their religious courts. I would want to limit how much it can do and what it has power to do.
Yeah,
You
and
never
it's
give.
always, it's going back to what we said beforehand about conflicts of law and so on and so forth. In England, you're governed by English law. And whilst you can select your own arbitration, effectively, this is what we're talking about. I guess ultimately it depends on the enforceability of that arbitration. Because if you disagree with the decision, what happens next?
Well, I think that you should. I mean, arbitration is quite tightly enforced, and that's why we're looking at. I think that's one of the reasons we're looking at the Arbitration Act. We started to look at it. We had a very good law commissioner in commercial law, and unfortunately, we lost her. And I'm not entirely sure how we lost her, but that was stupid because she was going to look at the Arbitration Act to see if we do need to change it. With religious courts, I think if one party says that they were coerced, we need to take that very seriously, and that needs to become unenforceable. And that's the way of dealing with that, in my particular view. We have to remember that we are British and that this is our tradition. I've talked about this, I think, in an episode a few episodes ago, but we've never gone somewhere and said you must have English law. If you cross the border into Scotland, they've got Scottish law. We didn't even make them do it. We don't. We never. We didn't make India do it. I've explained all this. We've all. This is really our tradition that there should be a free marketplace of law, legal systems, and the best one will rise to the top. And I believe that's how we've ended up with the best one. Because if you take a more Roman mindset, if you take like the French do, the French impose Napoleonic law throughout all their colonies, and they take the view that their law is the best law. Well, I don't believe French law is the best law, and I because it's got no competitor, it's ended up, I think, flabby and lazy. Whereas once you accept competition, and this is why I believe in the free market, I think one of the problems we have at the moment is we have large corporates who don't face any real competition, so they've ended up flabby and lazy, and that's what we have. We have this corporate socialist model using regulators and large corporations, and I believe in competition. I think competition improves things. I think in the media we're seeing people like you and me coming in and just being competitive and trying to get views, and Maya coming in and being the media and competing, and therefore putting everybody back on the stage. GB News coming in, God, they hated it, don't they? Really hated the idea of a new competitor. They really like this corporate socialist state because it means they can just be lazy. They don't have to do anything. Everything will carry on. But this is why corporate socialist states fail, because there's no competition. It's why the USSR failed.
And I think, I mean, certainly in terms of arbitration, it's as you say, it's a competitor. You're working on that sort of principle. An estimated 100,000 Islamic marriages have been conducted in Britain. A lot of those are not registered with the civil authorities. How are they, just by way of example, then, if we're saying that English law governs, what is the status of those marriages?
Well, they're not marriages. It's as simple as that. and you know, doesn't matter. You can, it's just, that's the line to hold. It's anybody who gets fluffy with that and starts saying, oh, we have to make a cat. No. We have a principle that you're only married if you're married in English law. If you're not married in English law, you're not married.
Yeah, and I
That's
think
it.
this is again what I love about these episodes. We've just cut to the chase. It really is as simple as that. Is you look at the relevant laws where you are and see what's relevant. And there was a famous case with good old Mick Jagger about whether he was married in a particular jurisdiction. You might recall that one. And say, well, hang on, it's not recognised over here. So these courts and what sort of happens, it's very easy for the men to get divorced. I think you just have to say three times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. But for the women, they have to go through these courts. In terms of English law, however, you have to look at the relevant law over here. And it's just, is it just culturally we're recognising it out of respect or how's it sort of working? Because if enforceability's an issue, it then becomes meaningless, doesn't it?
Well, we shouldn't be recognizing it. And what's happening, Andrew, is that we have, this is why we've ended up where we are. We are where we are because of end state liberalism. Everybody has been looking for what we call win-win outcomes. Nobody has been able, or nobody now has the courage to provide win-lose outcomes, except, you know, some of us lawyers. Nobody has the ability to say no now. So if people are running around recognizing these things, then they are in error and they must cease. And they must go back to a line that you hold. And one of the problems is that none of our lines have been holding. This is why we've been getting, this is why we will ultimately risk collapse. But things will get worse before they get better because the bad people will take advantage of you. We have locks on our front doors for a reason. You don't let the bad people in. You know, and Claire Fox made me debate. No, no more borders has become popular with the young people, and I knew it was popular with the young people. And she made me debate it in front of a room full of 80 young people. So I was just like, oh no, why? Well, I've got the short straw now. And my debating partner came in, and she was like, oh no, we're going to lose terribly. I was like, just leave it up to me. So most of the room was young women, and I pointed out that borders are clothes. Clothes are a boundary. Clothes mean no, you do not get to see what is under my clothes. Not unless I choose to. You know, no, fine. But no, you do not get to take my clothes off without my consent. And I, with that argument, I just got them on my side. They were just like, oh, that's what
And
they want to
see,
do.
and also, I mean, just using your example beforehand, I mean, it's like locking your door, isn't it? It's
Yes.
about security and safety, and you, in the same way as clothes is absolute great example there. But similarly, your home, you can lock the your home, and you'll feel a bit more secure. If anybody can come in without being invited, it becomes an issue. And I think putting it in those very simple terms, it's much easier for people to understand. And I think what happens, we're all brought up to be lovely to everybody, but there is consequences of loveliness, and I think it's looking at that sort of side. Well, look, it's been an absolute delight as always. We've galloped through some really important issues, but I think it's been worthwhile because I think the more we unpack it, the more we can understand why laws are in this way, and we will continue to question everything. But for now, Stephen, thank you very much for joining me.
Brilliant. Take care.